This is Poetry Off the Shelf from the Poetry Foundation, July 27th, 2010. I'm Curtis Fox. This week, the new poet laureate. Last month, the Library of Congress announced the appointment of W.S. Merwin as the new poet laureate. He will succeed Kay Ryan this fall. In American poetry, Merwin has been a central figure for many decades. He's now in his early 80s, and he has won pretty much every award an American poet can win, including two Pulitzers. The natural world, war, love, and time are preoccupations in Merwin's poetry, which is instantly recognizable for its total absence of punctuation. In a lot of his poems, there is a kind of vatic, almost bardic quality that is really quite rare in poetry these days. Many of his poems sing, although in a kind of dreamy, breezy way. We're going to listen to two poems that Merwin read at the Library of Congress in 1999. One of them is pretty straightforward, but the other one, well, I wouldn't say it's a difficult poem. It's just that I'm having some trouble with it. I'll give it one more listen when I play it for you, and if I still can't make heads or tails of it, I'm going to have to get on the horn to Mr. Merwin at his home in Maui. The first poem, the straightforward one, is called Vixen.
The vixen is not named for an embittered feeling about an old love affair. The vixen was a vixen, female fox.
See what I mean? Straightforward.
If you want to symbolize her, you can do that if you like, but you have to take her as a fox before you take her as a symbol. She didn't care about being taken as a symbol.
Fair enough. But keep in mind as you listen that Merwin is a kind of eulogist of the natural world that's rapidly degrading around us. He's also clear-eyed about our own simultaneous degradation and about poetry's quixotic attempt to regain a place for us in the natural order. The vixen, in other words, carries some extra weight in this poem.
Vixen. Comet of stillness, princess of what is over, high note held without trembling, without voice, without sound. Aura of complete darkness, keeper of the kept secrets, of the destroyed stories, the escaped dreams, the sentences never caught in words, warden of where the river went, touch of its surface, sibyl of the extinguished, window onto the hidden place and the other time. At the foot of the wall, by the road, patient, without waiting, in the full moonlight of autumn, at the hour when I was born, you no longer go out like a flame at the sight of me. You are still warmer than the moonlight gleaming on you. Even now you are unharmed, even now perfect, as you have always been. Now when your light paws are running on the breathless night, on the bridge with one end, I remember you. When I have heard you, the soles of my feet have made answer. When I have seen you, I have waked and slipped from the calendars, from the creeds of difference and the contradictions that were my life, and all the crumbling fabrications as long as it lasted, until something that we were had ended. When you are no longer anything, let me catch sight of you again going over the wall. And before the garden is extinct and the woods are figures guttering on a screen, let my words find their own places in the silence after the animals.
You could argue that this poem is not so much about a fox as it is about the thoughts and feelings aroused in the poet by a fox. The poem seems to load the vixen up with all the unknowable mysteries of the natural world.
Keeper of the kept secrets, warden of where the river went, window onto the hidden place and the other time.
And then the poet tries to get close to this world.
You no longer go out like a flame at the sight of me.
And his encounters with the fox start to separate him from the conflicted human world of time and personal identity.
When I have heard you, the soles of my feet have made answer. When I have seen you, I have waked and slipped from the calendars, from the creeds of difference and the contradictions that were my life, and all the crumbling fabrications as long as it lasted.
But the poet hasn't caught sight of the fox for a while, and perhaps he knows he can never really know what the fox knows. But he holds out hope that his poem can somehow achieve the unity with the natural world that the fox has, even as the natural world is disintegrating in our high-tech world.
Let me catch sight of you again going over the wall. And before the garden is extinct and the woods are figures guttering on a screen, let my words find their own places in the silence after the animals.
That, at least, is my quick and dirty take on that poem. For this next one, you're on your own. It's a mysterious poem with a bureaucratic-sounding title.
Memorandum. Save these words for a while because of something they remind you of, although you cannot remember what that is, a sense that is part dust and part the light of morning. You were about to say a name, and it is not there. I forget them too. I am learning to pray to Perdita, to whom I said nothing at the time, and now she cannot hear me as far as I know, but the day goes on looking. The names often change more slowly than the meanings. Whole families grow up in them and then are gone into the anonymous sky. Oh, Perdita, does the hope go on after the names are forgotten? And is the pain of the past done when the calling has stopped and those betrayals so long repeated that they are taken for granted, as the shepherd does with the sheep?
Hello.
Hi, Mr. Merwin. This is Curtis Fox. How are you?
I'm fine, thank you.
I just played for listeners your poem, Memorandum, and I have a very simple question for you. Who is Perdita?
Perdita.
Perdita.
Perdita. Well, Perdita is a... Of course, you know, Perdita means all lost one, and she's occurred in the poems going back quite a few decades.
Right.
And, of course, she was a character in Shakespeare, too. But to me, I mean, she is that lost one, whoever she is in anybody's life. And she's also, since she's apparently in another world, since she's lost, she may know more than we do. And so the question.
Oh, Perdita, does the hope go on after the names are forgotten? And is the pain of the past done when the calling has stopped and those betrayals so long repeated that they are taken for granted, as the shepherd does with the sheep?
This figure personifies loss and perhaps the wisdom of loss.
Now, is it fair to say that this is a poem about aging, or perhaps the forgetfulness that comes with age, or is it really that everything that we name, say, or do is eventually lost to us and to the world?
It's eventually, it may not be lost entirely, but it's transformed into something that is unrecognizable to us now. For example, if we read Shakespeare passionately all our lives, we're not hearing the Shakespeare that the Elizabethans heard, and we're not hearing the Shakespeare that Shakespeare heard when he was writing it either. We're hearing something else. That's one of the things the poem is about. What if this remains as itself? What is the poem? You know, the question behind it all is, where is the poem? When is the poem? Whose is the poem? These are unanswerable. The poem has some kind of life of its own that changes all the time.
And so beautifully with his image of a shepherd tending to his sheep, and with the idea that we should tend to our own pains and agonies and betrayals and with the same sort of care and, I guess, dispassion. I read into it a kind of Buddhism, a distance from one's agonies and the pains of living.
That's fair, but there's also this thing that I watched again and again, you know, the pain of the past, about which we can do nothing at all.
Right.
Those betrayals, which are part of our lives, and we never think about them. For example, I lived most of my life, in a tiny farming village in southern France.
Mm-hmm.
And for years, I watched flocks of sheep go up and down the lane right beside the house, with sometimes children and dogs and sometimes older men and sometimes people herding them nowadays with a small car, you know, up and down the lane.
Yeah.
And speaking to them politely and gently, but very firmly, and, you know, the shepherd knows something about the situation that the sheep will never know until the last minute. And, that you know, the shepherd is tricking the sheep all the time.
Mm-hmm.
He's deceiving them. And our life is made of deceits like that. There are these things that we don't remind ourselves about that we're not being truthful about. And do those remain in the form that we leave them, or do they remain in their true form, which is not so nice, you know?
Yeah.
I've been to the slaughterhouse where those sheep were killed, and I know the whole story.
Mm-hmm.
And it's one reason why I don't eat meat.
Yeah.
But, you know, the whole culture of shepherds fascinates me. It's very ancient.
It's very ancient. It's an image that comes up frequently. It's from sometimes your poetry, even though it's utterly contemporary, harkens back to a lot of ancient imagery, whether it's from shepherds that remind one of the Bible. And is that a deliberate tactic on your part to sort of mix a very contemporary take on the world with older forms of life?
Well, it's a piece of luck in my life. When I was in my early 20s, I found this village and this ruined house that was practically for sale for so little that I had enough money to buy it. And that's just a little over $1,000.
Uh-huh.
And it was a ruin, and I built it up, and it's been part of my life ever since and still is. We still go there when we can.
This is in France?
In France. Part of the hypnotic fascination of the place for me, and I love it very much, is that it has its roots in antiquity that is unbelievably ancient for an American.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I can look down across the valley to where they've discovered the first complete Neanderthal skeleton.
Mm-hmm.
That kind of antiquity. And the whole peasant culture that I moved into when I was still in my 20s.
Mm-hmm.
And where, unlike anything I knew in America, the past was something that they all took for granted. And it went back to the immemorial times. And it's very different from my American life. And I tried for years to sort of work out the terms in which they could live together. And I thought, I'm the terms on which they can live together. That's the way it is. I have to be happy about that.
Right. Right, they coexist in you.
I think we all mix the past and the present, whether we are aware we're doing it or not, because I think the present really is made of the past. The present and the past are inseparable.
Let me ask you a few questions about becoming the poet laureate. How exactly does that work? Does the Library of Congress just inform you one day that you are now the poet laureate, or do they first call you and see if you actually want to be poet laureate?
Oh, well, I've sort of kept as marginal as I could for many years, but when I read at the Folger in the end of April, and
the Folger in Washington,
Folger Library, the Folger Shakespeare Library, mm-hmm. and while I was there, the head of the Library of Congress sent a message to say that he would like very much if I could come and see him one afternoon, and I did. And he asked, he said, "Would you accept this post?" And I said, "Well, you know, I never wanted to because I don't want to live in Washington. I don't want to spend much time in Washington, wearing a suit day and night, you know, and it's not my life, and I like being footloose and independent and leading a very quiet and private life." So we talked about it, and he said he'd give me several weeks as long as I wanted to make up my mind and that we could do it on my own terms. I thought about that and had several more conversations about that to see that whether he really meant it, and he did.
Mm-hmm.
And so I said, okay, I'll try it this time, and he said, is there some kind of a theme that you would like to make a project about? And I said, I don't know about projects, but the theme would be the relationship between poetry and the rest of life, what people call the natural world, you know. Because I don't think there is any separation, and I never did.
Some recent poet laureates, I'm thinking of Robert Penske and a few others, have been very intent on getting poetry out to a larger audience.
Oh, he's been wonderful about it, yeah.
Is that part of your program? Is that what you're going to do anything related to that?
Well, I've been doing interviews, as you see, because I really believe, Curtis, that everybody really loves poetry. And if they don't think they do, it's because something has happened to deprive them of it. I think that just as children love to draw and to dance and to sing and do all those things, they also love poetry. You know, there are cultures where it doesn't get pushed out of them. I mean, the whole of Latin America, you know, there are two-page spreads in the morning papers of poetry.
Yeah.
People take it for granted. And in Mexico, I saw the most enormous turnout for Jaime Sabines at the Palacio de Bellas Artes a few years ago before he died. It was absolutely, you know, it's a huge auditorium, and the stairs outside were absolutely packed and down into the street with loudspeakers. And Jaime started to read a poem, and they all recited it with him.
Amazing.
You know, it's a different culture. It's possible. Those are human beings just the way we are. It's how they come to it.
Yeah, well said. W.S. Merwin, the new Poet Laureate, thanks very much.
Thank you, Curtis.
You can read a raft of poems by W.S. Merwin on our website, poetryfoundation.org, where you can also listen to a few more of his poems on the Essential American Poets podcast. Just do a search for Merwin. His latest book is The Shadow of Sirius, published by Copper Canyon Press. Please keep the emails coming. Let us know what you think of this program. Email us at podcast@poetryfoundation.org. The theme music for this program comes from the Claudia Quintet. For Poetry Off the Shelf, I'm Curtis Fox. Thanks for listening.